I wonder how Jesus is able to address 5,000 without a microphone. So, although I've been to the place where he addressed the 5,000, it's actually a natural bowl, which kind of parabolically focuses the sound. So, but that doesn't exist here. We need a microphone. Huh? Probably knew that, right? Now, I was mentioning as I was driving over here this morning, I saw a great statement of philosophy in somebody's bumper sticker. I fish, therefore I lie. All right, I got a number of emails from several of you yesterday at the office. They started coming in early yesterday morning, and I got more towards the afternoon. And basically, you're asking me to comment, what's going on with Stephen Hawking? Well, you can go to our website, reasons.org, and Jeff Swierink and I did about a 20-minute podcast on Hawking's announcement. And actually, from what we can tell, this is kind of what happens before a big boxing match where the boxers start yelling at one another and insulting one another. They know if they do that, they can drive up the sales. So I don't think it's coincidental that Hawking's book is going to be released at the end of this month. The book, ironically, is given the title The Grand Design. So, and he's just given up his chair at Cambridge University. He held the Lucasian chair of mathematics, the chair that Isaac Newton held. So, and, you know, during his illustrious career, Stephen Hawking has basically displaced Isaac Newton as the father of gravity. And so as Hawking travels around in the world of physics, that's kind of his title, the father of gravity. But a friend of mine at Caltech, Don Page, lived with Stephen Hawking and his wife for 4 years. Was a Christian, by the way, Don Page. And he said there was a moment when the father of gravity in his wheelchair took a turn and the wheelchair started to tilt over. And Don had to rush towards him to save him from succumbing to gravity. So his comment was the father of gravity was being humbled by the law of gravity. So, but you don't see that in these press releases here. And, you know, what really caught people's attention is that Hawking was claiming God is not needed to create the universe. Or God did not create the universe. Physics created the universe. Although, yeah, well, this one title is released in the British newspapers, God did not create the universe, says Hawking. Although a friend of mine in South Africa sent me an email and said the headline down there is, Hawking did not create the universe, says God. So, South Africa has at least twice as many Christians per capita as the United States. That comment is not at all surprising. So, but this is what Hawking has said in trying to promote his new book. Quote, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, and why we exist. Now, I think what's really driving this is an earlier quote from his book, A Brief History of Time. If you're not familiar with that book, it now ranks by far as the best-selling science book in all of history. Last time I looked at it, it sold about 22 million copies. Although people have joked that it's the best-selling unread book in science. How the vast majority of people who purchase the book purchase it to impress their friends and neighbors how intelligent they are that they're actually reading Hawking's book. But I will say this about his book. It's the best book I've seen anywhere that describes for lay people the physics of black holes. And if that's all the book had said, it'd be worth the money. And basically what I tell people, when you pick up A Brief History of Time, those are the chapters you want to read. You know, kind of let the rest of it go. Because the rest of it, Hawking waxes philosophical. But one of the philosophical statements he made in A Brief History of Time, this is another quote, if we discover a complete theory, what he means by that, a complete theory of physics, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we should know the mind of God. And ever since the early 1980s, that's been Stephen Hawking's goal, I've heard him lecture a few times. And, you know, his goal is that before he ends his life here on Earth, that he and other physicists would come up with what they call the theory of everything. They would discover an underlying theory of physics that would literally explain everything. And by the way, they mean everything. They don't just mean everything within physics. As Hawking explained in his book, A Brief History of Time, if we come up with this theory of everything, it will not only explain all the operations in the universe, it will explain all the operations in physical life, it will also explain human free will, and all the decisions that we make, we would literally know everything. Everything at a mental level, everything at a physical level, everything at a spiritual level would come out of this theory. And that's why he says we would know the mind of God. We would know everything that God knows. And all the pronouncements you see about his forthcoming book, The Grand Design, in my opinion, is Hawking starting with this presupposition, this goal that the mind of God is discoverable by human beings. And so he has come up with a theory of cosmology, a model for the origin and structure of the universe, the only model for the origin and structure of the universe that would permit human observers to discover a theory of everything. And so the standard Big Bang model won't let you do that. But what he's proposing is a model that would actually make it possible to come up with a theory of everything. In my opinion, that's what he started with. I want this theory of everything, and this theory of everything's got to be accessible to human beings, therefore this is the way the universe must be, and this is the way we must be. Now, a lot of people have looked at this announcement by Stephen Hawking as saying he's made a dramatic change in his theology, and now he's coming out with an atheistic worldview perspective. He's not doing that. His perspective is really no different than it was back in 1988. He is saying, yes, we need a God or some kind of entity out there that would produce all the mathematics and the equations of physics, but that's all God would need to do. Once God sets up the math and the physics, then he can take a 14 billion year vacation. And that's basically been the theology of Stephen Hawking since the mid-1980s, is that, yes, there is a God, but all God does is set up the math, and it's left up to us human beings to figure out everything else that that math does. And so the mathematics becomes the creator and the designer. When he says the grand design, what he means by that is that God has so elegantly set up the mathematics and the equations of physics that that will design everything. So let's quote the grand design. The designer is not God in Hawking's model. The designer is the mathematics and the equations of physics. Yes. Well, he was married to a Christian lady. His first wife, Jane, was an evangelical Anglican. And when my friend Don Page was living with Stephen Hawking, it was at the time he was married to Jane. Stephen was married to Jane. And what Don tells me is that every day they would have Bible study and prayer. And he said Stephen participated in that daily. They said it may have been for his wife's benefit, but he had no objections to it. But one thing that Don told me, and also his wife has written about this in the British newspapers, is that with Hawking, he was quite comfortable talking about God in a theistic context. But if you tried to push him beyond that, in Jane's words, the famous Stephen smirk would come upon his face, which was basically a signal, end of conversation. I'm not going to take it beyond that. And Don experienced the same idea, that you can get Stephen to a certain point and he just simply shuts down. So, now, he did divorce his wife Jane, and then wound up marrying another woman. It's kind of a sad story, but when he married wife number two, she, shortly after the marriage, got converted to Christianity in a Baptist church. And has been attending a Baptist church. How regularly Stephen attends with her, I don't know. So, but the Hound of Heaven is after him. I mean, his research partner, Roger Penrose. I don't think Roger's a Christian, but he's definitely a theist. He believes in a personal God, and a God who created the personality and the spirit of human beings. He may be a believer, I don't know, but at least he's publicly said that much. And so Stephen is surrounded by people who are either theists or Christians. So I think the Hound of Heaven is after him. And, you know, his life is only 68, so he's got time. Yes, John. Well, that is true, and that's true of most intellectuals who are atheists. Typically, it's someone in their early childhood who either, as a Christian, you know, did some dastardly deed, or as a Christian, applied tremendous emotional pressure. And Stephen does talk about how his mother did the latter. Yes. Well, his book has not yet been released, and you know, aren't excerpts of the book available. But in our podcast, we said, you know, he does make reference to Alexander Vilenkin, and he makes reference to his old research partner James Hartle. Well, back in the early 1980s, Stephen Hawking and the physicist James Hartle, who is at University of California, Santa Barbara at the time. Together they published a paper where they concluded we don't need God to explain where the universe came from. However, they had to speculate that the universe was constructed not with just one dimension of time, but the equivalent of two. He talked about this in his book, A Brief History of Time. He says, you know, all the measurements tell us that the universe and all of us in the universe are constrained to cosmic time, a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed. But he said, what if the universe, in addition to cosmic time, has imaginary time, which means the universe would have the equivalent of two dimensions of time? And what he did is he produced the mathematics with James Hartle that if that's the case, there's no need for the universe to have a beginning. And his conclusion was, if the universe doesn't have a beginning, what need then do we have for a creator? We don't need God. And he said that way back in 1988. However, what he was doing was the classic thing that Paul talks about in Romans chapter 1, where people ignore God and they attribute attributes to the creation that belonged to the Creator. And so what Stephen Hawking was doing was attributing operation capability to the universe that the Bible tells us only God possesses. And ironically, what the space-time theorem that Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose published back in 1970 states. Those space-time theorems, he produced, along with Roger Penrose and George Ellis, the first of the space-time theorems of a general relativity. And today we have space-time theorems that don't even require general relativity to be true. Those space-time theorems tell us that the entire universe can be traced back to a space-time singularity, an actual beginning of space and time. And the cause of the universe must be an agent beyond space and time that brings this universe of matter, energy, space, and time into existence. Hawking's own theorem proves that the universe is constrained to a single dimension of time that has a beginning, a moment before which it did not exist. And so that's the irony here, is that, you know, Hawking is actually contradicting his own work. On the other hand, he made it clear in A Brief History of Time, and also the research paper he published with James Hartle, that this was speculation. It was basically a what-if kind of theoretical work. It says, what if the universe had these properties? If it had these properties, then there is no need for a beginning. But we know that the what if is not true. So, and that's something, if you read carefully A Brief History of Time, he makes it clear that the physical evidence tells us there's just one time dimension. But he's right. If you put a second time dimension in it, then you can escape the beginning. Now, what he also overlooked is you go through the different holy books of the religions of the world. The Bible is the only one that says that God can operate in the equivalent of two time dimensions or more. It says God can arbitrarily compress time, and he can arbitrarily expand time. You can only do that if you have access to the equivalent of two dimensions of time. The other thing the Bible is very clear about is that God has no beginning, no ending, and is uncreated. That's mathematically impossible if you're constrained to a single dimension of time. But as I showed in my book, Beyond the Cosmos, it's quite easy to have those characteristics if you've got access to two time dimensions or their equivalent. It's not that hard to visualize. Let's see what I got here. Okay, consider a plane where you've got a length of time and a width of time. In such a plane, you can have an infinite number of timelines running in an infinite number of directions. Therefore, it would be possible to operate on an infinitely long timeline here that never crosses or touches the timeline of the universe over here. As such, that being would have no beginning, no ending, and would not be created. The Bible is the only holy book that says that of God. Now, what Hawking and Hartle did is they basically attributed what the Bible says of God and what the space-time theorems say is only true, the causal agent that brings the universe into existence. They transferred that to the universe. And in doing so, they said, we can get rid of the need of a beginning and a God to explain the existence of the universe. As I mentioned, that's classic Romans 1, 18 through 32. Instead of worshiping the Creator, they gave glory and worship to the creation. They attributed qualities of deity to the creation that belonged to the Creator. Well, we have lots of measurements in physics that tell us that the universe does not have that second time dimension. So, which means he may be appealing to Alexander Vilenkin's idea. And once again, Alexander made it clear this is speculation. And what he speculated is it possible that nothing is unstable? In other words, you have nothing, and it bifurcates into something and anti-something. You know, the analogy would be a proton and an antiproton. You can take energy and produce a proton and an antiproton, or you can take a proton and an antiproton, put them together, and you'll get energy. Now, it's not really creation out of nothing. You're converting matter into energy and vice versa. But uses that analogy that maybe you could start with pure nothing, and it bifurcates into something and anti-something. And if we can find some way to isolate the something from the anti-something, that could explain the universe in which we live. Well, to Alexander Vilenkin's credit, he did say this is a speculation. And what he was saying is there some other way to look at the universe where we don't have to have the Big Bang creation model with a creator beyond space and time? And he says, if you start with that assumption, one way to get around that is to presume that nothing is unstable. And what he's really saying is there's some hidden law of physics that will allow something or nothing to bifurcate into something and anti-something. Now, that obviously is a clear contradiction of the first law of thermodynamics. You probably all remember that from your junior high days. That first law says nothing can be created or destroyed. And it's based on the fact that all of our observations and all the sciences tell us that you can't get something from nothing. It doesn't work in the stock market, doesn't work in the chemistry lab, and doesn't work in the physics lab either. We've never seen any examples to the contrary for 14 billion years. In other words, if it was really true that Alexander's speculation was valid, that nothing is unstable, we should see stuff popping into existence all the time. We don't. The first law is the thing that we realize can never be violated. Yes. Well,
if it has the characteristic of being able to create something from itself, then it's not true enough.
Yes, and to Hawking's credit and Vilenkin's credit, they're not saying exactly that. And as I mentioned here in the class before, whenever a physicist talks about nothing, you've got to ask him, what kind of nothing are you talking about? In the physics vocabulary, we have five different kinds of nothing. And so this is not true nothing, and Hawking and Vilenkin would admit that. What they're claiming is that it's really the physics that causes nothing to produce something and anti-something. So it's not truly out of nothing. You have to start with the physics and the math. They're basically claiming there's a hidden law that physicists have yet to discover, a creation law or something of that kin. It's very similar to the speculations of Fred Hoyle in the steady-state theory of the universe, where he said there is this pervasive creation law throughout the universe that is spontaneously bringing new matter and energy into existence on a continual basis. What Blinken is basically saying is it's episodal. The critique he would have of Fred Hoyle is he was looking for a continuum of creation with respect to time. And so Hawking and Blinken are speculating that maybe it's kind of like quantum mechanics, where you get these quantum leaps of something coming into existence out of nothing. But philosophically, it's no different than what Fred Hoyle was speculating back in 1948 with his steady state model. So, yes, John. Well, Hawking's willing to concede that. He says, if you want to, call a mathematics God, or call the equations of physics God, or call the hidden stuff that's doing all this God. He says, if you want to do that, you got my permission, which is why I think it's accurate to refer to him as a deist rather than an atheist. Well, what is new about Stephen Hawking's statements is that this is the most explicit he has ever gotten that God, if he exists, is not personal. In the past, he was vague about whether or not God was more than just something that produces mathematics, but now he's being explicit. There is no personal God. So it's kind of like the God of Spinoza. God exists, but he's not a personal being. But as you point out, Ross, it leads to a fallacy, because we human beings are personal, we human beings are spiritual, we think, we feel, we make decisions. Physics doesn't do that. Mathematics doesn't do that. And one of the things we see throughout all the sciences is you can never get a greater effect from a lesser cause. And so the problem with this speculation, you're expecting pure mathematics to produce something greater than itself. So if God is not personal and the mathematics is not personal, how do you explain where the personality of the higher animals, human beings, how do you explain the spirit dimension of man? Mathematics doesn't ask questions like, why am I here? We human beings ask questions like that. We're the ones that are looking at the math and saying, why is it the way it is? You never hear equations of physics wax philosophical. They just don't do that. So that's one major fallacy. And then the other fallacy is, how can you get something from nothing? So, but before I take any questions from this side of the class, what I'd like to share with you is that Hawking claims that it was a discovery in 1995 that caused him to become so dogmatic about the lack of an impersonal God. That 1995 discovery was a discovery of the first extrasolar planet. And I'll just read you what he said here. It says, the 1995 discovery of a planet orbiting another star other than the Sun helped deconstruct the view of the father of physics, Isaac Newton, that the universe could not have arisen out of chaos, but was created by God. Quote, that makes the coincidences of our planetary conditions, the single sun, the lucky combination of the Earth-Sun distance and solar mass, far less remarkable and far less compelling evidence that the Earth was carefully designed just to please us human beings. End quote. And Hawking attributes that as the reason why he's come up with this book, The Grand Design. He says, you know, my predecessor, Isaac Newton, was wrong where he said it requires a personal being to explain all the design that we see in the Earth and the solar system. He says the discovery of extrasolar planets disproves that. Now, when I read that, I was stunned. I said, I don't think Stephen Hawking has looked at the extrasolar planet catalog. And by the way, all you need to do is put an Exoplanet Encyclopedia into any search engine, and it'll pop up the catalog. There's a French astronomer by the name of Jean Snyder that's actually keeping an up-to-date list of every single extrasolar planet that's been discovered. The list as of yesterday has 490 planets. However, the Kepler satellite has just discovered 700 more. So it's going to go from, it'll be around 1,200 within just a week or two. So, but if you look at that catalog of 490 planets, you'll discover that none of them have the characteristics of any of our solar system's planets. So here's Hawking saying the discovery of these planets shows that everything in our solar system is ordinary and not designed. Actually, the extrasolar planet is showing exactly the opposite. The anticipation, I remember when this first planet was discovered in 1995, the anticipation of astronomers was, we're finally going to understand our solar system, and we're going to be able to give support to the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, because we're going to find planetary systems all over our galaxy that are just like the planetary system in our solar system. Well, 15 years later, they're now coming to the sobering recognition that the universe, our galaxy, is hostile to advanced life, except for this pale blue dot in which we reside. And, you know, when I debated Victor Stenger at Caltech last year, that was his comment. He agreed with me that, yes, Earth is it. Everything else is way too hostile for the support of advanced life. So that's the irony here. Hawking changes his mind based on a wrong premise about these extrasolar planets. Okay, I don't know which of you are first, so...
A joke,
all right, we need a joke.
So we're referring to the five different types of nothing and the first law of thermodynamics that nothing can be created or destroyed. These theoretical physicists probably meet Clinton, his math, who will point out that the first law, nothing can be created and destroyed.
There you go. Thank you. But you got a follow-up. So you had a follow-up to that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in certain models of the universe, space and time are somewhat interchangeable. I mean, all models of the universe, the time dimension geometrically behaves like a fourth space dimension. So yes, they do have models of the universe where they eliminate time, but they bring in exotic space dimensions to complement length, width, and height, and the six tiny dimensions that accompany our universe. You know, all of these speculations require an appeal to some kind of extra or trans-dimensionality. And by the way, one thing my colleague Jeff Zwirink made very clear yesterday in our podcast, all of these speculations are still subject to the space-time theorems that we have, which means that there must be a first cause. There must be some agent that's responsible for bringing into existence either the math, the physics, or the universe. So none of the speculations of Stephen Hawking or Alexander Blinken escape the force of the space-time theorems. I would also add they don't escape the force of the incompleteness theorem. It was the German philosopher Goethe who made the comment that, this is back in 1930, that you can never come up with a complete understanding of a system unless you have the capacity to get outside that system and learn everything about that system. Now, one of the things that's very clear about the physics of this universe is that we're constrained to live within the universe. We are not transcendent. We're constrained by the space-time dimensions that on which the stars and galaxies of matter and energy are distributed. And by that basis, it's impossible to come up with a theory of everything. We'll never come up with a complete understanding of the physics of the universe because we're not transcendent beings. And so by that basis alone, Hawking's goal is proved mathematically impossible. It can't be done. Now, for God it's possible because he transcends. But for us human beings, it's impossible. So the space-time theorems are a strike against Hawking's speculations, and the other thing is the incompleteness theorem is as well. Yes, Al?
Yeah, but to me, it all boils down to the fact that God is all perfect, right? Why didn't he create a perfect universe, or why did he create such flawed creation like humans?
If well,
perfect. So that tells me that maybe he's a second-rate God or something, you know, if there is a God, which I'm not conceding. But why are we so flawed that the universe is a bunch of chaos, if you look at it? So,
Well, the argument you're making is a very common argument. It's probably been popularized most successfully by Francisco Ayala at the University of California, Irvine. And by the way, he claims to be a believer, but he says, I don't think God is involved in bringing about the organisms we see here on planet Earth. So he believes there is a God. He's a Roman Catholic, and actually was studying for the priesthood before he became an evolutionary biologist. But the reason why he says it's got to be theistic evolution and not theistic creation, he says, look at all the bad designs we see in the different organisms here upon the Earth. That's been picked up by Richard Dawkins. He gives that as a reason for his atheistic worldview. And likewise, BioLogos, the people, that's probably now the most prominent of the theistic evolutionary organizations, they give that as a primary reason. Yes.
This is the answer to it's a very good book.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've been dialoguing with those folks, and that's one place where we sharply differ. They claim there's all these bad designs, and in particular, they're convinced there's lots of bad designs in the human body. The examples they give is the useless appendix. Another example they give is the inverted retina of the human eye. Another one would be the backbone, the fact that our back is so poorly designed, and now that I have got back trouble. They talk about the larynx, they also talk about the adenoids and the tonsils. And yeah, I remember growing up in Canada, and when I was in the first and second grade, I saw all of my classmates going to the nurse's office. And they were all being lined up to have their tonsils and adenoids removed. And about half of them had their tonsils. Somehow I escaped. You know, my mother's a nurse, and she stepped in and said, you're not taking out his tonsils and adenoids. So but anybody in the class who had more than one cold per year had their adenoids. Well, I mean, 6 and 7 year olds having less than one cold a year, what are you thinking about? When they're all jammed together, they don't know how to keep their germs to themselves. So, but it was all based on the presumption that these were useless organs that were left over from evolutionary mistakes. And likewise, I remember in the 1950s, if you went to the hospital for abdominal surgery of any kind, they always took out your appendix. And the assumption was the appendix is a useless organ, and we got to get it out because anything could happen where it could get inflamed and we'd have to take it anyway. Let's just get rid of it right away. Well, most of you are probably aware the medical industry has stopped taking out tonsils and adenoids, and they stopped taking out the appendix. We now realize that all three sets of organs play a critical role in the human immune system. But the presumption back in the 1950s was that if the appendix doesn't serve a function in terms of human digestion, it's a useless organ. They weren't looking for other purposes. They were only looking for, quote, the most obvious purpose. And likewise with the backbone. You know, Francisco Ayala says, I can come up with a much better backbone design, a much better design of the knees, for example. As nobody points out, human knees are a horrible design. Well, and what he was pointing out is, in terms of being able to run and walk, we can come up with a much better design for the knee and the backbone than we see in the human body. Now, what I believe he was overlooking was this. God foresaw when he created Adam and Eve that a time would come way into the future when there'd be human beings living in wealthy nations where they'd be spending 10 hours a day in front of a computer console. So, hurting humanity, that wasn't a problem. But that's the amazing thing about the human backbone. It's the optimal design if you're going to be having to be challenged to sit for long periods of time, to lie down for long periods of time, to walk for long periods of time, to stand in front of a podium like this for several hours. You know, it's much more challenging to stand than there is to walk. Standing is far harder on the back than walking is. And then, of course, being able to run. And so when you look at all the things the human backbone can do, then we realize what a remarkable design is, including that little tailbone we got. It all plays a crucial role in the human body being able to withstand the pressures of being able to sit for long periods of time, stand for long periods of time, walk, run, and lie down for long periods of time. We can do all that thanks to our backbone. Although there is some evidence that maybe it's not so good to be 7 feet tall. You know, the longer the backbone, the more stress there is. And, you know, historical records show that when the average height of the human male was more like 5 feet, back problems were non-existent. But now that we're at 6 feet and 6.5 feet, because, for example, the Dutch have more back issues than people of shorter stature. The Dutch are the tallest people in the world. And then I don't know why they have tall people playing basketball. Basketball is a sport that's very hard in your back. But that's where we send all the tall people. So, yeah, we mean we're getting them doing the wrong things. So the inverted retina, I mean, there's lots of articles on this on the website. And, you know, Dawkins makes a big deal about how horrible a design the human eyeball is because we have this inverted retina. Well, he's right in one sense. The fact that the retina is inverted means that the human eye is much less sensitive to light. However, the problem with the eye is you want it to be able to work where the light where the light is very, very bright. The only animals we see with a inverted retina are those that live in the ocean or those that live in really dark places where there's no risk of having to deal with very bright light. But the advantage of the inverted retina is it works where the light level is low. It also works where the light level is high. Moreover, because the retina is inverted, it's possible to jam together the light-sensitive rods in the human eye in such a degree that you can get very high resolution. The octopus, which has a inverted retina, doesn't need high resolution. But the human eye or the eagle, all birds and mammals, for example, have inverted retina. But because of that inverted retina, you can have high resolution without a big eye. There are creatures with inverted retina that got pretty decent resolution, but their eye is really big. And so we have a relatively small eye, but it has high resolution because of the inverted retina. And the inverted retina also makes it possible to have a very copious blood flow so that you can remove the heat. Wherever you got light, you got heat. And when you got that much heat, you got to find some efficient cooling mechanism. And with a inverted retina, you do not have an efficient cooling pathway, but you do. And you can read all about this on the web. In fact, if you go on the web, it's interesting. You'll see the atheists writing their articles claiming how horrible the eye is. And then you see these Christians writing articles basically rebutting it. But the textbooks now no longer claim that the inverted retina is a bad design. They do realize it's a very elegant design. Or as one biologist pointed out, it's got to be an elegant design because if it wasn't, why would all the land vertebrates have an inverted retina? Yeah, go ahead, Al. So no question we're morally flawed. I grant you that.
The other thing is that I probably shouldn't have said that there was no perfect beings. At the beginning, at the Garden of Eden, if we can believe the Genesis, it was perfect. Except that he brought in the apple and the devil. So they screwed it up again. So he did make us, he did screw
Al? You need to read Why the Universe is the Way It Is. Because in the Garden of Eden, things were good, but they weren't perfect. The perfect is coming in the future, and the perfect can't come about unless you introduce evil. Evil is a critical component to get the perfect creation. Adam and Eve, unlike believers and followers of Jesus Christ today, lacked eternal security. They did not have an eternally secure relationship with their Creator. It was always at risk to their free will. And so Satan and the evil that Satan brought in set in motion a plan that God is working out. It's not yet finished, but he's still working it out, whereby the good can be transformed into the perfect. Or I could put it another way. What we see in the Garden of Eden is the perfect creation to bring about the end of all evil, but it's not the ultimate creation. And so in one sense, every follower of Jesus Christ today is in a far superior position than Adam and Eve before Satan came in. I mean, they had the potential to live forever, but they would not be able to live forever in an eternally secure state with their Creator. Christians today are going to die physically, but one thing they got going for them that Adam and Eve didn't have, they have that eternally secure relationship. And eternal security really is a valuable thing. And incidentally, look at all the holy books or religions of the world. Only the Bible promises an eternally secure relationship, and only the Bible gives you any proof that eternally secure relationship is something you can know is true. And the first guy to figure it out that we have a recording of is Job. He was able to develop an eternally secure relationship. But it's because he had an understanding of evil and suffering that's way beyond most of us today. No, it's just that he had that relationship with his Creator where he's able to figure out, you know, he figured out God, he's called a man of faith and a man of remarkable humility and wisdom because he was able to study the record of nature and figure out God's plan of how God was going to eliminate evil and bring about this perfect state. So, anyway, if you haven't read the book, take a look at it, Al. And if you haven't got the money, I'll give it to you. Over here.
About the word good, I don't think that in the Bible it discriminates between good and perfect. For example, when someone called Jesus a good teacher, he said only one is good. So isn't good synonymous with perfect?
Well, good is synonymous with perfect, but you have to look at the context. The reason why I say that, in Genesis 1, we have God creating through the six creation days. You know, and after each day except for one of them, he says, it's good. And after he's done, he says, it's very good. Now, you can translate that, as many theologians have done and said, therefore it's perfect. But the question you have to ask is, perfect in what context? It's perfect to bring about the end of all evil. Keep in mind that evil was already present. Satan was already there. A third of the angels had joined him in rebellion. God created these human beings to counter the rebellion of the angels. Satan struck back and said, well, here's God creating these human beings. He was worried that the humans would supplant him. And so Satan dove right in there to foul up what God had done in the Garden of Eden. Of course, God knows everything and realized that Satan was going to do that very thing. In fact, God opened the way and said, he basically allowed Satan to come in. I think that's one thing that's very important to understand. God had the power to keep Satan out of the Garden of Eden and away from planet Earth for all of eternity. But God made it possible for Satan to invade because God knew he could transform that invasion and the disaster that flowed out of it into something that would bring about a higher good. So everything Satan is doing is exactly according to God's plan. You know, that's a remarkable thing about wicked and evil people, is they think they're striking back at God, but in fact they're falling right into God's plan. You know, a perfect example of that would be Pharaoh. In the back. Yes. Well, Yeah, my wife and I used to do these weekend conferences for Christian college students, and we were a little concerned about the level of pride we saw amongst these kids born and raised in Christian homes concerning their purity. And it's like, well, your purity's never been tested. I mean, how can you claim to be pure if it's never been put to the test? And so the real measure of your morality is how you behave when there's temptation. And so if it's never tested, and see, that's the thing. Adam and Eve lacked eternal security. Unless they've been tested, you can't ever gain that. The test is crucial to gaining that eternal security. You know, the example I give in why the universe is the way it is what everybody who has a PhD degree retains. That piece of parchment you get when you pass your PhD test basically guarantees that never again will you be tested for your competency in that discipline. And it's based on the myth that your professors had already subjected you to the most difficult tests, therefore it's pointless to test you again. So unlike medical doctors, I don't have to go for a board for retesting. I have this guarantee. So, well, that's what God's doing for us. He's purposely putting us through the most difficult tests. You know, I argue that it's not an accident that God allowed Satan to come in rather than a lesser demon. God's goal was that the most powerful creature he ever made would be the one that would test Adam and Eve and tempt them to disobey him. And so what that guarantees is that we are being subjected to the most difficult tests. But another part of the analogy, the PhD experience that I talk about in Why the Universe, is I remember the very first week I showed up at the University of Toronto. There were 13 freshman graduate students in our group. And the professor sat us all down and said, look, University of Toronto, this is the best institution in Canada for studying astronomy and physics. You guys are the cream of the crop. We know you're all very intelligent and very hardworking, but one thing we promise you, if you do not receive our help, you will not pass and get your degree. And their prophecy proved to be true. I can realize a number of my colleagues that didn't make it because they wouldn't receive help from the professors. Well, likewise, God is telling us, you're not going to pass this test of life unless you take help from me. I'm here, I want to help, but you're a free will being. I will not force myself upon you, but if you want my help, you will get my help. And with my help, you will pass this most difficult test. And when you pass this most difficult test, you'll get the equivalent of a piece of parchment that guarantees that never again will you be tempted by evil and suffering for the rest of eternity. And that's how we gain something that Adam and Eve never had. Yes.
Perfect in the New Testament, teleos, I believe, is often means if it fulfills the purpose for which it is created, then it's perfect. And it's not necessarily by fault, you know, by New Testament. And so it's interesting that that wooden translation of the Hebrew for good is functional.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, back to the backbone analogy. Our human backbone is not the perfect design for running. Neither is it the perfect design for standing or sitting. But to do all the combination, it's the perfect design. And so function is everything. What is the function of what you're trying to bring into existence? And again, an easy way to put this to the test, and we sat down with the BioLogos folks, that was our comment, was, you know, our differences can be tested. If you think the human body is filled with all these bad designs, and likewise there's all these bad designs in other animals, let's see if we can find purposes we haven't searched for yet, and see what comes up. And, you know, their big thing is how flawed the DNA is. And says, well, you know, we have the position that what we call junk DNA really has hidden purpose. Let's look for that and see what we find. Now, if you guys are right, then we'll see accumulating evidence that it's useless and has counterproductive purposes. And we'll also see increasing evidence that that's more true for the most recently appearing species on the Earth than those that have been here a long time. Now, let's do the research and see how this plays out. So we can put this to the test. But, you know, the fallacy is similar to Stephen Hawking's in thinking we already know all we need to know. There's a lot more to learn. And even when we learn everything we think we need to learn, it'll simply show us how much more we've yet got to learn. The incompleteness theorem again. You're never going to get a complete understanding. You'll get a better understanding, but it'll never be complete. Two hands up here again. I don't know who's first, so. Well, the standard position coming out of BioLogos is that the more recent a species appears on the face of the Earth, the greater the accumulation of useless parts or non-functional parts and useless DNA and a counterproductive DNA. And then, you know, their point is you look at the human genome, it's big. And because it's, they would claim its size is simply a testimony of the accumulation of junk over the millions of years of naturalistic evolution that's going on. Well, could it be that there's a lot more going on in the human genome than meets the eye? I mean, one thing that's come about the past few years is how far more the human genome focuses on development than the constructing of functional proteins. I mean, that was the first place the geneticists look. Their presumption was that the entire genome simply had blueprints for building the proteins. Well, we now realize, in the case of the human genome, that's less than 1% of our genome that does that. The rest of the genome is serving other purposes in terms of defending the organism against foreign attack, like retroviruses that we see there, or on-off switches that control the development. I mean, one thing about us human beings, it takes us 20 years to grow up, although some parents would claim it takes 30 or 40 years to grow up. And the whole point is it takes a lot of DNA to make sure that development occurs in just the right place and just the right time. I mean, it's one thing to have an on-off switch, but you want to make sure that on-off switch is turning on function or action in the right part of the body. You know, and this goes on from the time you're in the womb, just a few hours after conception, all the way up to when you're about 24 or 25. So that takes a lot of DNA to make all that work. And, again, you know, my colleague Fuzz was here. He says that's one of six purposes we've identified in what we used to call junk DNA. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
I like the evil and suffering because it goes to the core of our purpose of being here on Earth.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I like that because, you know, when you look at Genesis 1, God is saying it's very good when evil is already in place. So, you know, Satan's there, the fall of the angels, the third of the angels is there, and yet he's saying it's very good. How can he say that unless he's got a plan in mind to bring about the end of all evil, as you're saying, at least to separate it into the lake of fire where it has no possible contact with God's creation from that point forward.
I've often amused continually expands forever and stuck in it into a bottomless pit.
Or the ekpyrotic model, where it all disappears into a singularity and you get stuck there too. It's going to be hot.
You didn't have your fantasy, I'll have one.
He introduced the possibility of evil and suffering.
As a father, I give my kids, my three-year-old kid, a loaded gun to play with. Now, I know that eventually it will happen that this kid will pull the trigger and kill himself or hurt somebody else. So if you say, if you look at it that way, then God is totally responsible for all the evil and the suffering because he gave us free will. If he hadn't given us free will, it would be perfect, Nick. See what I'm saying?
Yes, but it would be diminished, Al. If he didn't give us free will, we wouldn't have our personality, we wouldn't have the capacity for love, and God's desire in creating was to magnify his love. And that required granting free will to all of the spiritual beings that he made. Yeah, no one would suffer. But it'd be like my computer. I mean, and you're prepared to give up your free will and become a robot?
In a minute?
Or you would be a robot. You'd be like this computer. I mean, I can program the computer. It's got a voice thing in here. And every morning, I can say, Hugh, I love you. I think you're the greatest guy. You know, I could do that. But I'll tell you, it wouldn't. That's my fantasy, right? Well, yeah, I think you can get my point. It's one thing for my computer to tell me what a great guy I am. It's quite another one if my wife says that. Yeah, she's a free will being. My computer is not. It'll only do what I program it to do. And so
we would be like a computer.
We would be like computers, exactly. And if we were like computers, there'd be no personality, there'd be no relationship. We would simply be machines. And see, God was not content only to create machines. He wanted to create creatures, beings, that he could form a relationship with, where they could relate to one another, and they could relate to him. In other words, magnify the expression of his love. That's only possible through free will. Now, God knew ahead of time. He takes a risk. When he gives free will, he takes a risk that people exercise that free will to rebel against him. But what you see in the Bible is, God had a plan in place, that if that were to take place, he would find a way to transform that rebellion into an eternally secure, loving relationship with him, where we retain the free will, but there would never again be the possibility for evil and suffering for the rest of eternity. Now, that's got to be the best possible thing. You're not a robot, you're a free will being, and yet, just like that robotic thing, there's no possibility of rebellion, evil, or suffering. But with a free will being, that's only possible if you're put to a test. And that's what's happening on God's creation day 7. He's putting us to the test, the greatest test possible, but he's also there to help us pass that test. And so, like all of us, Al, what you need to do is say to God, I want your help to pass that test. Okay, over here.
Assuming that you have the capacity to say it's a flaw.
Right.
When actually the flaw is there, we don't learn what those reasons for those things are, maybe in centuries from now. I mean, that's part of the design. That we learn some of that now, but for us to sit here and say our back is misdesigned now or something like that, we don't have capacity to understand that. And the same thing I would say, and so that's why to bring that up as a reason for disbelief, that's putting you in the place that you think that you have the capacity to say there's a flaw.
Sure.
And I'm going to take that step further. In the same thing why we say that Satan came and tempted us, and why we have evil in the world. We don't understand the good that's eventually going to give us. That is in God's plan, that this good will eventually come to us. We don't have the place to understand what that the function of that evil and how overcoming that will present the eventual good.
Excellent point. And you know, as a scientist, I say, you know, another issue we're looking at here is science productivity. You know, presuming that there's all these bad designs, what does it do to science research? It causes us to stop looking for the purpose and the design that's there. So if you have the presumption that God's behind it, God knows what he's doing, these designs are optimal, that's going to motivate me as a scientist to look for things I can't presently see. But if I think it's all flawed, I'm not going to bother to look. Now, I'd also say that applies to theologians and philosophers. If you think God doesn't know what he's doing, it's going to cause you to go on the wrong path in terms of your theological and philosophical research. And again, this is testable. Okay, let's test the philosophical paradigms that are out there by how productive they are in explaining things at a philosophical level. And so I would argue that if you do that, the Christian worldview has a much higher level of productivity in a philosophical community. And incidentally, one good piece of evidence for that is the percentage of Christians in the research philosophical community has risen dramatically in the past 100 years. Why? Because it's more productive than the atheistic worldviews that are out there. And of course, we can apply those same tests at a scientific level. You know, which worldview is more productive in developing scientific advance? So, okay, we got about 5 minutes left. I was going to get into a lesson, but let's continue with your question. Go ahead.
I'm a kind of new Christian. I asked this question in the Bible class. How can God give us bodies at all? Why do we need to do that? And actually, I came up with my own answer. I'm not buying it. God first created spirits. He created matter. Then he did this amazing thing of merging the spirit and matter together into a new creation. The angels can't suffer that way. But we can. So we're going through a school of hard knocks. And when we come out of this merging thing, where we have to deal with the physical universe at a really tight level like this, and still have our will, that's why I think he said we're going to be higher than the angels, because we've got this experience of the universe. Head-on collision with it, you know, fall down, break it on, and so on.
That's an excellent insight. I mean, the angels suffer at a spiritual level, the fallen angels. We get to suffer at a soulish level, intellectual level, that is, at a physical level, and a spiritual level. So we get it all. But because we are being subjected to the most extensive of all possible tests, and that's why we will be elevated to a position higher than the angels. Well, notice how quickly Lucifer jumped in to intervene once God set up the epitome of his creation, human beings. Satan was very eager to mess it up. I'm arguing, by the way, that Satan is still at work to do that. He's still doing whatever he can to destroy the image of God in humanity. So there's a certain jealousy that's in operation there. And what Paul tells us in his epistle, especially in Corinthians, is that we human beings, compared to the angels that are not fallen, the good angels, says we also have an advantage. They watch the grace of God operating in us human beings. We experience the grace of God operating within us. So they are observers. We are on the playing field. And for that reason, we are able to be trained to a degree in a capacity that the good angels are not. Right. But it also tells us that these angels are eagerly and intently watching us to learn as much as they can about the grace of God. To them, it's a mystery because they don't experience it. You know, we get to experience. Now, it's still lots of mystery for us, clearly. I mean, that's one of the goals of being a Christian, is in your Christian life, do what you can to comprehend and understand this grace of God that's flowing through you. But it's a little bit easier for us to do that because we are experiencing it rather than simply watching it. But also I think it's crucial, as a Christian, that we watch the grace of God operating the lives of people around us. You know, we've been talking in our lesson about how God supernaturally intervenes to bring life and death, to preserve life and to bring death. I think it's important that we have time with people that are dying, because you get to see the grace of God operate in ways you don't normally get to see. And sometimes I think because of the way we live in our cities, we isolate ourselves from being able to see the full impact of the grace of God at work. We cut ourselves off. Yes. Right. Well, I mean, as I've said here before, Satan's strategy, he knows what God's plan is. But he figures, you know, God is so loving and so merciful that if Satan and his demons can work in such a way to bring the downfall of enough human beings, then God's going to have to let them off. And if he lets them off, maybe he'll let them off. And it's kind of like, you know, when you're taking an exam and you're looking around you and saying, I just got to make sure I get enough other people to fail as badly as I'm failing. And maybe the professor will show some grace and mercy. Grading curve. Well, that's why as a professor, I don't grade on a curve. If they're all performing badly, they're all going to get bad grades. But likewise, if they're all doing really well, they're all going to get good grades. Hey, we're out of time, but I'll take your last question, then we'll go.
You know, I'm sitting here with my 10 to the 14th synapses and brain cells, and I'm going to figure out what God's doing. And, you know, he gave us this nice book here and explains things. It gives me his Holy Spirit. How am I possibly going to contemplate these things, analyze the spine, the eyeball, that stuff? Yeah, this is what I think it does. Ask that amoeba about the space-time theorems. As a human, try a little infant, a human that's pretty close to you. Explain it to that little infant.
Well, I think that's a helpful analogy. You know, God is to us as an amoeba is to us. Only, or an electron to us, exactly. So we need some humility here. We really do. Thank God we got that book. Yeah, where would we be without it, right? Okay, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we do want to thank you that you seem fit to write to us, to send us a communication, a book that will help us get through this life. Thank you. We have some clip notes to get through this challenge that you placed each of us here for. And Lord, we know we're here to be tested. And we thank you, Lord, that you're so gracious and loving that you'll step in and give us the help we need to pass this test. Lord, I pray you impress upon each of us and people we run into in the course of our studies and work and our recreation, Lord, that you give us the words to speak, the wisdom to communicate, and the grace to communicate how, Lord, we can't do it on our own. Without your help, it's impossible to pass this most difficult of all tests. So, Lord, I pray that literally this week you give many of us opportunities to be that ambassador, showing people how they can get the help they need to pass this most challenging test. In Jesus' name, amen.
Good questions, Ross.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you already got things going.
Thank you.
It wasn't for you. I don't think we would have done all this.
Appreciate that. Talked to Bob Stewart this week after the apologist conference call, which
right.
I was there for most of it. I was talking to him specifically about the speakers